to dream.
Everyone, we have an announcement. We just want to make sure that everybody knows about Thrive 2006 that's happening this Saturday. It's a free carnival-esque event that's sponsored by the Community Health Initiative and the Undergraduate Council. We're featuring lots of exciting workshops about acupuncture and acupressure and yoga and Pilates. Also, lots of free food, lots of raffles. We're raffling off an iPod Nano, digital camera, and lots more. You can buy raffle tickets from any CHI member or any UC member. And proceeds from the raffle go to Relay for Life. So we hope to see you there. Thanks.
And the event is on Saturday from 2 to 5 in the MAC.
Thank you.
Morning, we are the Xi Pledge class of the Eta Psi chapter of the Alpha Epsilon Phi fraternity, and we're finishing up our pledge period. So in order to commemorate this, we are going to sing a little piece of our song for you before lecture.
True to colors, gold and blue, as the heavens above. Born beneath old NYU, to thee we give our love. Gold and blue, thy colors wave on high. We will always trust in you, Alpha Epsilon Pi.
Thank you.
Hi, good morning. Good morning. So just a quick recap from last time, and we're going to continue today. We spoke about perfectionism versus excellence. These are the definitions. Remember them. And the key issue here, the key issue is that it's about the journey as opposed to the destination. We can be just as ambitious or even more ambitious pursuing excellence. It's just that we have a very different schema regarding the journey of getting from point A to point B. Perfect journey, straight line. Pursuing excellence, at least according to these definitions, much more meandering, much more flexibility, much more dynamic versus static, much more acceptance versus rejection, because there is only one way to get from point A to point B. Looking at the full part of the glass rather than the empty part of the glass. Why? Because if we're obsessed with not making mistakes, this is what we focus on. This is what keeps our attention. So what I want to talk about today, or start to talk about today, is the consequences of perfectionism. So what if we do have the schema? And many of us do. It's pervasive, especially in Western culture, not just peculiar to this campus. What are the consequences? We talked about the temporary relief and the life of the rat racer. Why the rat racer? Because there is real unhappiness in the journey. So yeah, there is temporary relief when we get there, when we get into the high school we wanted to get into, the college, the job, the promotion, the raise, but then it's temporary, it's ephemeral. And we move on back to the rat race. Versus a person committed to excellence who can enjoy lasting satisfaction. Most of life is about the journey. Our present is the present, the here and now. A perfectionist, there is inevitable failure every step of the way. Why? Because I have not yet met a perfect person. I've not yet met a person who just doesn't fail. So there is inevitable disappointment. Person committed to excellence, there's a possibility of success every step of the way, also when there is the so-called failure. Cognitively reconstructing the situation and asking, so what can I learn from this? How can I improve? Looking at it as a stepping stone rather than as a stumbling block. A perfectionist wastes a lot of time. The borders have to be perfect. Every word has to be read and reread 100 times. A person committed to excellence is committed to excellence, to doing great work, but there is an appropriate allocation of time. With some projects, you want to be extremely precise. You want to go over it 20 times. You cannot afford to make a mistake. This, by the way, applies to people running organizations. There are places where they need to check and recheck everything, but there are places where they can delegate and can afford to make a mistake. That's where they create the psychological safety that we talked about last time. This is a big one. Very high correlation between perfectionism and various disorders, such as eating disorders. Anorexia, bulimia, highly correlated with perfectionism. And it makes sense. Let me tell you something that I experienced related to that. So when I was playing full-time squash, I paid very close attention, strict attention to my diet. Would only eat healthfully almost always. I have a weakness for sweets. And especially, you know, if there is one perfect thing in this world, it's my mom's cooking. So my mom's cakes, I would come home, you know, after a long day practicing and open the fridge, ready for dinner, and there'd be a cake there. Beautiful, tempting, luscious, delicious cake. Just looking at me, saying, hi, welcome home. So I open the fridge and look at it and I say, bye. And I close it and I go away. About 10 minutes later, like the sirens, it calls me. And I return to the fridge and I look at it and it says, hi, and I say, bye. 5 minutes later, I run back to the fridge just to make sure that my brother didn't eat it. Now, those of you who know my brother, he was here, he's a much bigger guy, so he can eat a lot, right? Just to check, closing the fridge again. And then, about 2 minutes later, running to the fridge, taking out the cake and devouring it. All or nothing. Either a perfect diet or I binge. This is all around us, this all or nothing. Either I'm a supermodel or I'm overweight. And we're going to talk a lot about this later on today. And this schema enters into our cognition, and we start to accept it, and we are then most prone to disorders. Person committed to excellence, there is a healthy approach. Sometimes there are deviations, nobody's perfect, but I can continue going on my path towards success, whatever success is, whether it's becoming fitter, becoming healthier, more successful in school, athletics, work. Finally, as we talked about last time, perfectionism hurts self-esteem, and it hurts self-esteem, and I'm going to repeat the three reasons why it hurts, because they're significant. The first one is because if we're constantly failing, again, there is inevitable failure here because reality can never match the schema. So in our mind, we're failing. And if we tell ourselves constantly that we're failing, it's going to affect our self-esteem. Second, Nathaniel Brandon's, one of his pillars of self-esteem, self-acceptance. There is no self-acceptance here. There is constant rejection because no one can live up to these standards. And finally, because we don't cope, because we don't take risks, because we are afraid of failure and therefore don't try, don't fall and get up again. We start to see ourselves not as courageous, but as fearful. We start to see ourselves not as people who can overcome difficulties, but as people who avoid difficulties. And remember, if we want to increase our base level of self-esteem, not just go the regular ups and downs that are natural, but the base level of self-esteem, we have to cope. We have to go into our stretch zone rather than remain in our comfort zone. So this is why, these are the three reasons it hurts self-esteem. Person committed to excellence, there is continuous improvement. Why? Because where there is success, it's improvement. Where there is failure, there is potential for improvement, for learning, whether it's within a relationship, whether it's studying an exam, whether it's trying out for a play. Perfectionism hurts relationships. And as I mentioned last time, I've experienced this not once and not twice. Why? Because you can't really create intimacy when there is defensiveness. And why is there defensiveness? Just to reiterate what we talked about, because if this is my schema, I don't like when there is inconsistency between what is inside and what is outside. And whenever someone points out, you know, failure or imperfection, I immediately become defensive, protecting my cherished schema. And it's very difficult, maybe impossible, to create real, genuine intimacy when there is defensiveness that is so pervasive. And everyone has some levels of defensiveness, human nature. But the question is, once again, of degree. And we're going to talk a lot about this when we talk about relationships in 2 or 3 weeks' time. Finally, person committed to excellence allows for growth. One thing we're going to talk about when we talk about relationships is that the ideal relationships are not the quote-unquote perfect relationship where there is perfect harmony, seeing eye to eye on everything. These are not perfect relationships. These are repressed relationships. Ideal relationships, there is some conflict. And we'll talk about how much and what kind of conflict is the healthy conflict. There are naturally ups and downs, periods that are not great, periods that are amazing. But gradually building to a better and better relationship over time. And again, much more on this in 2 or 3 weeks. A perfectionist constantly experiences anxiety and stress. I talked about the knot in my stomach that was there all the time, whether it was when I played squash or when I was an undergrad here. There were moments of relief, like after between graduating from high school, you know, for you and going into school, or for me after the military and before getting to Harvard or freshman week, but temporary. The knot returns. And people experience the knot in different places. You know, for some it's feeling choked here, for some it's tension in the shoulders. But there is anxiety, fear of failure that's constantly there, versus creative tension. This is more like excitement. It's important to have that, you know, to be in the stretch zone, to want to do things, to be slightly anxious before, you know, I go on and speak in front of an audience. That's healthy, that's creative. Versus the choking that I described earlier, where it's completely debilitating, where it's, going back to the definition, incapacitating. Okay. Fine. I think I made my point. But, and here is a big but. What about performance? Because, yeah, I know I'm paying a price. I have a knot in my stomach a lot of the time. I experience anxiety a lot of the time. But no pain, no gain. Most of us have the schema embedded in us. And some of it is true. You know, if you want to be a top athlete, of course you have to work hard. And it's painful at times. Of course, if you want to do well in school, you have to work hard. And sometimes it's not the most pleasant thing, reading the notes for the third time. I go over my lecture notes at least 4 times before every lecture. You know, by the third time, I'm not surprised anymore. No, less interesting. Yeah, hard work certainly is part of doing well, but a lot of the pain that we experience, and this is what I will argue now, is unnecessary, especially the emotional pain that's associated, that's intimately associated with perfectionism. We can have far less pain and gain more. In a sense, eat the cake and leave it whole. Let me make my point. The first question that we need to ask ourselves is, how do we define success? Do we define success according to the material perception or to the happiness perception? Do we define by what currency? And as you know, what I will argue for is that ultimate success is about the ultimate currency, about being happier. And a person committed to excellence is clearly happier than a perfectionist. But that's not the only currency where it pays off. It actually pays off in the quote-unquote hard currency of achievement, of gains, of successes, as we define it here in the West. Why? Various reasons. One of the reasons. It's a much more sustainable approach to growth. If we have this schema in our mind, we're much less likely to sustain hard work and commitment to a cause than if we have this schema, recognizing that there will inevitably be ups and downs on the way. For various reasons. One reason that we're less likely to sustain it is because here we don't enjoy the process. In other words, there isn't intrinsic motivation going into the work. And remember when we talk about self-concordant goals before break? People who are intrinsically motivated will work harder, will be more successful, and will be more creative than people who are only pushed, literally pushed by an outside factor, the extrinsic motivation, getting to point B and then succeeding there, or thinking that one will be happy there for a long time. The second reason why it's not sustainable is because the all or nothing approach. So we want to work on our fitness, and we go out and do the 10-mile run immediately instead of building up. This specifically is what ended my squash career. Because I went to play in London, observed John Shere Khan, and said, I'm going to train like him, all or nothing. Either I don't train at all, or I train like the world champion. And I got injured, and it wasn't sustainable. We talked a lot about procrastination. Winston Churchill, quote, perfectionism spells paralysis. Why? Because no one likes to fail, and especially when we catastrophize failure. So we choose not to start at all until we have no choice, when the extrinsic calls or pushes. Much more likely to procrastinate. Talked about self-esteem and what Nathaniel Brandon says. Remember, self-concept is destiny. If we have high self-esteem, we're much more likely to succeed. Person committed to excellence has higher levels of self-esteem. Now, this doesn't mean perfectionists cannot be successful. There are many perfectionists who are successful. But what I'm saying is that given the same initial conditions, controlling for all other variables, a person committed to excellence will be more successful in the long run than a perfectionist. Not that a perfectionist cannot be successful. It's just more successful. And that, to many people, is counterintuitive. And yet there is a lot of research that shows that. The basic premise of this class, learn to fail or fail to learn. There is no other way to success. It's no coincidence that the most successful people in history were also the people who have failed the most times. The luck factor. The article that you read before break. Let me read to you some excerpts from it and from other writings by Weissman, who is a professor at the University of Hertfordshire in the UK. Weissman says, quote, "My research eventually revealed that lucky people generate good fortune via four principles." Remember what he does in his research. He demystifies the concept of luck, saying, yes, it's true that there are lucky people, people who are luckier than others, who have lucky breaks, who succeed more in the long run. But he says there are reasons for it, and he is pointing to these reasons. And the four principles are: they're skilled at creating and noticing chance opportunities. This is all in your article. They're skilled at creating and noticing chance opportunities. Make lucky decisions by listening to their intuition. Create self-fulfilling prophecies via positive expectations. And adopt a resilient attitude that transforms bad luck into good luck. So these are the four things that he lists. And then he talks about the four tips for becoming lucky, because he's been able to create what he calls the luck school. People come in and they actually become luckier after, having identified these principles. Again, this is a serious scholar doing excellent work in this field. And here are the four principles. Principle one that he talks about: listen to your instincts. Perfectionist rarely listens to his or her instincts. Why? Because there is one way or the highway, not going off on hunches. Because hunches are more risky than doing the quote-unquote most rational thing, which will lead to minimum failures. Second, be open to new experiences and breaking the normal routine. Break the routine. In other words, flexible. A perfectionist is not flexible. Remember, static. One way is the only way. A person committed to excellence is much more likely to meander, to get off the routine. And he gives simple examples in his article, even taking a different road home from work. The little things ultimately make a big difference. Three, spend a few moments each day remembering things that went well. In other words, what he's saying, focus on the full part of the glass. A person committed to excellence is much more likely to focus on the full part of the glass. Even when there is a downturn, he or she is much more likely to look at it as a potential stepping stone. A perfectionist tends to look at the empty part of the glass. This is about doing the gratefulness exercise, learning to focus on the positive. And the fourth thing that he says is, visualize yourself being lucky before an important meeting or telephone call. Luck is very often a self-fulfilling prophecy. Now, he's talking about visualization. He has something that is not just right here. Yes, we need to visualize, but you remember the work by Taylor from UCLA? What she says about visualization is that we shouldn't just visualize the end, we should also visualize the process. And the study that she ran was giving the task of visualizing success on an exam to two groups. The one group just visualized succeeding. The second group visualized the process of getting there. And that group was more successful. So it's visualizing the journey and the destination, which is exactly what a person committed to excellence does. People committed to excellence are much more likely to be lucky. We talked about creativity. Simonton talked about it last time. The most successful artists and scientists in history also had the most failures, the most duds. Creativity requires, a prerequisite for it, is that we try things out, that we meander, that we learn to fail. 80-20 rule, the Pareto's principle. Pareto was an Italian economist who, back in the beginning of the 20th century, noticed an interesting pattern. For example, 80% of the wealth is owned by 20% of the people. in organizations, 80% of the revenues come from 20% of the clients. 80% of the work is being done by 20% of the people. And what time management researchers have found is that this applies to the way we construct our day. And it applies on two levels: when we work and how we work. In terms of when we work, we have natural rhythms in the day. There are people who are morning people, there are people who are night people. In the 3 hours, which I call our productive hours, around 20% of the day, we can do 80% of our work. For some people, it's first thing in the morning, you know, 7 a.m. to 10 a.m. For other people, it's at midnight. Everyone's different. And again, there are physiological reasons for this difference, because our cycle is not a perfect 24 hours. And for people whose cycle is less than 24 hours, say 23 hours, they're morning people. Why? Because they're ready to wake up in the morning, or even before they actually wake up, their body is ready to start a new day. People whose cycle is, say, 25 hours, wake up in the morning, i.e. 11:15, just before this class, and still need a few more hours of sleep. There are night people. They can stay up till 4 a.m. in the morning. So know your nature. What are you, a morning person or a night person? And act accordingly as much as possible. This, for me, made a big difference in college, because initially, like most students, I did my work at night, until I read about this and realized I'm a morning person. I get up early and I'm productive, and I started protecting my productive hours. And when my roommates started doing their work, I went to sleep. That made a big difference. I became much, much more productive. The other place where it applies to time management, and this also made a huge difference for me, is that we don't always need to do the perfect work. And somewhere toward the end of my sophomore year, when I realized this, when I realized I was here and not having a good time, this is one of the changes that I introduced. And I stopped doing all the reading. Or when I read, I used to skim some or get some notes from others. Not all or nothing. Sometimes, when I was very interested in the material, I did put everything into it. But not always. And an interesting thing happened for me as a result. First, my grades went down, but very slightly. Very slightly. But what happened overall, I became much more successful. Suddenly I had time to play squash again. And I picked it up, not at the same level as before, but I played quite seriously my junior and senior year. Second thing, I started developing workshops. That was the time when I decided I wanted to be a teacher, and I developed workshops, which I then ran, initially for my team, and later over the summer, where I worked, became much more successful professionally, and I started to have much more of a social life, so I became happier as well. 20 or 80-20 rule can make a big difference. Think about your lives. Think about where you can cut down on the perfectionism without paying too high of a price very often. Finally, the flow experience. For a perfectionist, let's say this is the arousal level, and we talked about this model before. This is the arousal level, and this is performance. Sorry, wrong way around. Arousal. No, other way around. This is arousal, and this is performance. So when our levels of arousal are very low, we don't perform well. We perform better here, and then it goes back down again. A perfectionist, in terms of arousal level, is right here, very high, anxiety. If you're bored, you're here. This is the flow distinction, remember? Boredom here. Sorry, this is the performance. Performance, and this is arousal levels. This is the optimal performance, where arousal level is just right. This is the excitement. This is the creative tension that a person committed to excellence experiences, as opposed to the anxiety, the choking that a perfectionist very often experiences. But the question then is, so if excellence is so much better, both much more fun, and we're more successful at it, why are so many of us perfectionists? What are the sources? Where does it come from? As I said last time, the reason why it's important to understand the sources are twofold. One, so that we can overcome it once we understand it better. Two, so that we don't pay it forward. Because very often we pay it forward, whether it's to our kids or to our students or to our employees, if we're in leadership position, it's contagious. So how do we stop it? Well, if we understand it, we can do it better. And the source is conditioning. In our society, success is highly overrated, failure is highly underrated. What we're conditioned to do is to celebrate destinations, to celebrate the A, and to almost completely ignore the journey of getting from point A to point B, because the journey is just something that we have to get by. You know, it's inevitable, you know, we can't get directly from A to B, so we do it with briefest time as possible, as perfectly as possible. We don't celebrate it. When was the last time that teacher would say, wow, you know, the process for studying the exam is phenomenal. You're getting an A for that. No, we get an A or a B or a C for the destination. And over time, when we also get it from our parents, who got it from their parents, why? Because it's so pervasive. It's so obvious. It's so much around us. I mean, I see it now raising my kid. And I'm aware of this. I have to stop myself and say, look at the destination as well. Appreciate that. And we get a schema, we internalize that schema. The destination, we get reward for it, and then we're accepted. In contrast, the journey remains unrewarded, and then it's just a means only. Incidental, we just have to go through it. We have no choice. And we internalize it, and we no longer need the external voices to tell us this. This is the way we operationalize, and this is the schema that we internalize. A related research done by Carol Dweck, she's a professor at Stanford, is the following. She looked at kids who were rewarded for their intelligence versus kids, these are two randomly divided groups where she rewarded one for one and one for the other, versus kids who were not rewarded for their intelligence but were rewarded for their effort. In other words, intelligence is, you know, something that's a given, an end result in a sense. Effort is the journey. And what she found was that subsequent to the activity, after they were rewarded in one way versus the other, if everything went smoothly, both did okay. But as soon as they faced hardship, as soon as it was suddenly difficult, possibility, a real possibility of failure, the group that was rewarded for their intelligence very often stopped, or if they couldn't stop, they became very anxious and performed poorly. Versus the group that was rewarded for their effort, when they faced difficulty, they became even more energized. We're going to overcome this brick wall. So it has repercussions both for their happiness, levels of anxiety, and also for success. Less pain, more gain when rewarded for the journey. Think about it. Think about also how you reward yourself. When do you take yourself out? After the paper is over, or while you're working very hard on the paper, I did good work here. Do you ever say that to yourself, or do you just talk to yourself after the exam, badly or well? And as importantly, think about how you pay it forward to people who are looking to you for rewards. The social environment, it's pervasive. I mean, social psychology is all about understanding what power the environment has. We're constantly primed, explicitly or implicitly, by perfection. And there is no permission to be human around us. Rather, there is pressure to be perfect. And it's all around us in the media. All around us in the media, we see perfect men and women are much more the victims of this kind of depiction than men are. Now, I was browsing the web and looking for covers of women's magazines. What does it say there? I don't know. Maybe I don't want to know, right? Okay. All right, go on, translate those who don't. What does it say, do you know? Okay. You'll tell me after. Or not. So I was browsing through, and the reason why I put an international magazine there is to show that this doesn't just happen in the US, this is global. All right, maybe I should change the slide. All right, enough. So I was looking through magazines, and I found this magazine from 1896. It has changed slightly, right? The cover, you know, they have some very interesting articles there. You know, they talk about art. They talk about Phoenix Park tragedy, an extraordinary political crime. You know, they have serious articles there. Cosmopolitan looks very different today. So I picked one. Sex goddess secret. But look at the words, God, perfect. Not human, God. Look at the other ones. All right, don't look at this one. But look at how to get ahead fast, right? It's not let's work hard, let's learn to fail or fail to learn. No, let's get ahead fast. These are the messages that are all around us, constantly. Just go to out-of-town news. I mean, it's mind-boggling what goes on there. And there is a cost. There is a cost to it because look at this. These pictures, by the way, came together. I didn't put them together. No, what's her first name? Richie? Nicole Richie. So here she is, and look at the picture that they're putting. You know, eating, overweight, and here she is after the diet. It has a price. There are consequences to these images, to this kind of priming, unhealthy consciousness. Over the last 3 years, I had two seniors write a thesis with me on these things, self-esteem and body image in the media. Serious negative consequences to happiness and to well-being. The social environment, there's no permission to be human. There's pressure to be perfect. And again, who decides what's perfect? Again, a social construction, and an unhealthy one at that. Now, there are people who are working against it, and one of these people is Anita Roddick. Remember her? I mentioned her last time. She's the CEO, was the CEO and founder of The Body Shop. She has a book called Business as Unusual. We talked about it last time. So, in 1997, I was living in Singapore at the time, and I organized an event on self-esteem. And the event was, I brought Nathaniel Brandon over to Singapore, and he was going to be and he did eventually talk in business organizations because they could afford to bring him over and, you know, and pay him. But then my girlfriend at the time was working with a body shop, and she said, you know, we have a campaign this year on self-esteem in women. And she put me in touch with Anita Roddick, and their campaign, which I became a part of, not as a model, yes, I know you're surprised, but rather with Nathaniel Brandon. What we did, we organized an event in Singapore on women and self-esteem. The event sold out. There were 700 women there. Mostly, there were some men as well. It was telecasted because of high demand, and Nathaniel Brandon ended up writing a book after that event, in which he mentions that event on self-esteem in women, writing it with the help of his wife, because there was such high demand for it. Now, what was the body shop campaign? Why am I telling you this? The body shop campaign was the Doll Ruby. Does anyone remember this? I mean, this was 10 years ago in 1997. The Doll Ruby, and it appeared in all the store windows. And the body shop they do a lot of work for the environment. They do a lot of work for women's images, a lot, very similar to what Oprah does in many ways. So here is their campaign, the Doll Ruby. And here is another poster which they used. Can you read it from the back? There are 3 billion women who don't look like supermodels and only 8 who do. The body shop. Another campaign poster. Hey media, where we come from, cultural and physical diversity is the norm. It's called Planet Earth. Very effective campaign, but it's not enough, once again, because there are very few voices that try to make the social change, and that exacts a price. The movies, Perfect Love, High in the Sky, Top Gun, 9.5 weeks. And we're going to talk about this perfect love and its consequences when we talk about relationships. But these are the images that we perceive. Again, okay, so it may take me a few minutes to pursue her, but then I'll find my perfect love and we'll have an amazing time. Or relationships. And what I'll talk about is that movies end where love begins. Movies end here. Love begins here. The self-help books, we talked about it. Think and Grow Rich. Yeah, it's a good book. There are some good tips here. But it's just part of the story. And when people get this magic, well, all I need to do is think about point B, and then I can get there, as opposed to character change that was part of the self-help movement before the 1930s. Remember the two periods, pre-1930s, when we had a person like Samuel Smiles, who talked about hard work, the British self-help author from 1859. Wrote about character change, hard work, wrote about biographies, showing how people struggle, the natural ups and downs, the excellence path. Not less ambitious, as ambitious, but not unrealistic. 5 steps to the perfect marriage, 3 steps to ultimate happiness. The 2 things you need to know to have self-esteem. Or books like these. Small steps to big happiness now, not after struggling and going up and down, not during the challenge, right now, quick fix. And that, as Marcy Seligman talks about, exacts a very high price when we have this schema in mind. Again, this, by the way, might be a good book. I haven't read it. I just got it off Google. Okay. So it's all around us. What do we do? What do we do? Any suggestions? What do we do to overcome perfectionism, especially when we know the power of priming? Remember all the studies that show us how powerful the environment is. When we are bombarded by perfection, when we are bombarded by larger-than-life figures, whether on Men's Health cover or Vogue or in Top Gun. There are a few things. The first thing to remember is that it's a long process. It doesn't happen overnight. I became aware of my perfectionism, I told you, when I was just over 23 years old, the time I was a sophomore here. That's when I realized I have no reason, allegedly, to be unhappy, and yet I'm unhappy. And I understood that I was a perfectionist, that I had this schema. I mean, this explicitly I didn't understand then. It was much later when I did research on it that I came up with this. But more or less, I had an intuition of what was going on. I'm still dealing with many of these issues. Karen Horney, the psychologist, one of the mothers or the grandmothers of positive psychology, we talked about her at the very first lecture. She has a book on neuroses, and she says there, neuroses never completely go away. They'll always be there. But it's a question of degree. As I said, there is no perfect perfectionist, and there is no person perfectly committed to excellence. We're all along the continuum. So 13 years ago, when I started thinking about it, I was much closer to the perfectionist end. Today, let's say I'm here. 5 years from now, I certainly hope to be here, and I hope to continue growing till the day I die. It's like happiness. We talked about it. You can't really ask, am I happy or unhappy? I mean, what does that really mean? The question is, how can I become happier? Because if happy or supremely happy is here and extremely depressed is here, we're all somewhere along the continuum. The question is, how do we move more and more toward the happy side of the continuum? How can we become happier? How can we become more committed to excellence? Again, while not giving up our ambition. Why is it difficult for many people to give up perfectionism? When we talked about change, we mentioned Alan Langer's research, where people fail to change very often because they fear that changing will exact a price that they're not willing to pay. So for instance, we're not willing to give up our rat race because we think that giving it up will make us less successful. We're not prepared to give us our perfectionism because subconsciously, because of what we have been taught and primed to believe, we believe that giving up our perfectionism will make us less successful. But the reason why I argued so strongly before is to show you that it's not the case. We can relinquish our perfectionism, be as ambitious as we were before, be happier and more successful. So that's the first recognition, that we want to overcome our perfectionism or parts of it, or if we don't, that's perfectly fine too, of course. The first thing, awareness. In everything that we want to improve, we first need to be aware what we want to work on, whether it's a backhand in tennis or whether it's perfectionism. For me, it became very clear with relationships. I was being defensive. Started catching myself, in a sense, being defensive when I shouldn't be, when I should have reached out or being grateful. I noticed this also with my eating habits. You know, I described, you know, it was funny, but that wasn't funny for me many times. So being aware of it as a first step. Let me show you an example of some sort of levels of self-awareness. Whether it's high self-awareness or low self-awareness is up to you to decide.
Hey, Jackie Brown.
Why didn't you get coffee?
Same reason you don't have a wife and three kids. It's the way God wants it.
An office, there should be coffee.
Hey, why don't you save your anger for the bedroom? bottom where it belongs. Why don't you go see your little coffee cutie, huh? Your latte lover? Mr. Jock full of nuts?
He quit, all right? What is this, a freaking Inquisition? Can a guy have a nice hot cup of coffee when he wants, or do we all live in tea land where it's a capital crime to even say the word coffee?
Okay, Jitterbug, get a hold of yourself.
Don't tell me to get a hold of myself. Fine.
Okay, you may want to take a look in the mirror, because you got a little crazy on your face.
Karen, what's happening to me?
I'm no expert, but I think you have a little addiction problem. No tears on the damask.
Addiction? Oh, no. No, I don't have an addiction. Thank you very much.
I'm fine. Now listen to me. The first thing you have to do is admit that you have a problem. Because if you can't even recognize the signs, then you are really in sorry shape. Why are you so good to me?
Karen, I can't do it. I'm hooked on the junk.
Well, hey, if it'll help you, I'll do it with you, okay? I'll kick coffee, too. Yeah, it won't be easy, but every morning when I wake up, I'll just have to get used to drinking my Bailey's straight. It'll still be the best part of waking up.
Okay, Karen.
Okay.
Together we can do this. Let me just have one last cup.
No.
Half a cup.
No.
How about you drink a cup and I'll lick your tongue?
Tempting, but no.
Okay. When will the lamb stop screaming?
First step, awareness. After being aware of it, active acceptance. Now, I talk a lot about active acceptance. I have a whole article on it in your readings this week. But let me tell you a story that I don't talk about in the article, which made me realize the importance of active acceptance and what it actually means. Because it's not just acceptance, there is an action component to it. When I was an undergrad here, one of the most famous psychologists in the world came to town, not to Harvard, but to BU. And I had read that psychologist before, admired him a great deal, because what he wrote about was something that I was interested in. He wrote about the ability to dissociate oneself from the social, environmental pressures. I knew how much the social environmental pressures affected me, and I wanted to overcome them. And he actually wrote about it, where he said that we don't need to be dependent on what other people are saying or thinking, where we can become fully autonomous and independent. I loved his message. I read everything that he wrote. And I went to listen to his lecture at BU. The lecture was phenomenal. I was completely blown away. After the lecture, there was an after party, which I attended. And there were many people there, and he was making his rounds, and I followed him. And I went up to him, and I said, "Professor so-and-so, thank you so much for your lecture. Thank you for your writings. I've read all your works." And he said, "And what did you think of my lecture?" And I said, "It was phenomenal." He said, "Great," and he moved on. And I followed him, a groupie. And he went to the next person and started talking to the next person, and within a few seconds, "So what did you think of my lecture?" And the person said, "It was amazing." Spoke for another couple of minutes, moved on, the next person. And he was the celeb there. Next person, So what did you think of my lecture? Oh, it was great. It was phenomenal. Continued talking for another minute, and they moved on. First question out of his mouth, so what did you think of my lecture? It was unbelievable. It was great. And so he continued, one person after another. And I'm watching there. And then he goes to another person. So remember what that person looks like distinctly. I should later find out he was an alum from here, and he went to this lecture also admiring this this professor. And the professor asked him, as he asked every single person, so what did you think of my lecture? To which the other person responded, overall, I thought it was great. Overall, what do you mean overall? What didn't you like about it? With such obsession and such zest, and I thought to myself, what is going on here? What is going on? You know, this person who devotes his life now to showing how we can become completely independent from what other people are saying is completely obsessed, at least from the way I saw it, completely obsessed with external evaluation. I care about how my lectures are going, and I often ask people, but with such obsession. And then I realized something very important, that there are certain things that we need to accept. One of them is the fact that we care, that we are social animals, and that there is no someone who only cares about what other people think or someone who doesn't care at all, except for the psychopath. But the normal people are somewhere in the middle on the continuum, and the challenge is not to go to one extreme or the other. It's to move further along to the extreme that we want to move along. So yes, I did want to be more self-determined, more self-concordant. But the first step in becoming more independent is also accepting the fact that we do at times care, whether it's what our boss says or what our spouse says, and it does affect our self-esteem. And we'll talk a lot about that when we talk about self-esteem in the two last lectures of the semester. Active acceptance. Accept the fact that it's part of being human to care, and then choose. And that's the active part. That's the significant part, because I can still care what the social environment is telling me to do, but then I can choose what I really, really want to do. It may not make me feel great at this point, but I can still have a choice. Active acceptance. How does this apply to perfectionism? We all have part perfectionist in us. It's inevitable. The first step is to accept that and to say it will never go away completely. And it's fine, it's there, it's part of being human. Because one thing that perfectionists often do, I don't want to be a perfectionist at all, and if I ever see these tendencies, then I'm no good, failure. A perfect journey from point A to point B, whether this is overcoming perfectionism or whatever it is. So they apply their perfectionism to trying to overcome perfectionism, which doesn't work. It's counterproductive. Because when we suppress something that is natural, that is real, when we repress it, it actually becomes stronger. And this is what I think, again, I never spoke to him about it, but this is what I think I saw in that professor, suppressing a human need, a social need, which is natural, and part of it is beautiful and nice. Suppressing it, ignoring it, and then it becomes even stronger. For me, this was an important turning point, because until that point, that's what I wanted to be like. Completely autonomous, completely independent, don't care what other people say. And paradoxically, when I allowed myself this feeling, the caring, it stopped having such a strong hold on me. And I became much more independent in practice. And also in terms of my attitude and my experience. But again, much more on this when we talk about self-esteem. Actively accept. And how do we act? Or why is it so important to act? Because behavior, our action, ultimately changes our attitudes. Some of the things that I did. I went out of my way and solicited feedback and criticism. Initially, it was very difficult for me to hear it. And literally, I had to hold myself from not saying, yes, but, or attacking back. It was so ingrained in me, this defensiveness, not wanting to move away from the perfect line. But I held myself. My behavior over time changed my attitude, and now I'm much more open to being criticized for feedback. It's certainly making my relationship much better. Another thing that helps us overcome perfectionism is getting out of our comfort zone, stretching, taking the road less taken, risking failure or a stumbling block, and then moving on. For me, again, I did it in the realm of my relationships. Her name was Brittany. She was a showgirl. At least to me, she was. We were freshmen together here. I know. And we met freshman week. And I was in love. And I mustered up enough courage to ask her out during freshman week. And I thought, I'm going to have this relationship, the very least, for my 4 years here. She didn't think so. Somewhere halfway through my sophomore year, when I had this realization of being a perfectionist, I said, I'm going to put myself out on the line again. I tried again. I asked Brittany out. And I thought, well, at least we'll have 2.5 years together, and then we'll live happily ever after. Once again, she didn't think so. My junior year, I was in a relationship, a wonderful relationship. Then my senior year, unfortunately, the relationship ended. And Brittany was still here. It's funny how it worked. We were freshmen together, and then we were seniors together. So much in common. And I thought, I'm going to try again. And by then, and I was a 26-year-old senior, much, you know, very mature, or so I thought. And I went and spoke to her. I was much more confident then, and we had an amazing conversation. And really, do you know those kind of conversations where just everything clicks? You know, you're really funny. I was just on. And she was off. She said no. It didn't work, but I coped. I put myself on the line. You know, someone during office hours last week came to me and I said something, we're talking about ideas, and I brought up Rena. Remember my other showgirl from when I was 12? Who also said, again, a lot of similarities between her and Brittany. And I spoke about her, and the person in the office hour said to me, what, Rena was real? I said, of course she was real. What, do you think I'll just be telling you a story? So Brittany is also real with one difference. Her name is not really Brittany. I'm not going to tell you her name, and here is why. Because I was giving a workshop in... I was giving a workshop in West Orange. There is a school for the arts, which is interestingly run by or sponsored by Cicely Tyson. And Cicely Tyson heard about my workshops because she knew how highly I speak of Marva Collins, and she played Marva Collins in the movie, on Marva Collins. Anyway, so I was invited to that school to give a workshop, and I talked about similar topics, and the story of Brittany came up. And I said her actual name, and she has an unusual name. These are high school kids. They went on the web. They found Brittany. They contacted her. They asked her, and she said, I'm sorry, I'm married. So fifth time, no. So this is why I'm not going to tell you her real name. But other than that, every other part of the story is true. All right, let me move on now, okay? Do you mind if I move on? Thank you. Let's go to something which is less threatening to me, meditation and visualization. We're going to devote a whole lecture to meditation, and we've spoken about it before, about the amazing research that's out there. Meditation does lead to calm. It leads people to be much more accepting of the journey. And visualization, we've spoken about this in the Beliefs of Self-Fulfilling Prophecy lecture. What we can do, and what I often do to deal with my perfectionism, I see myself, for example, speaking in front of you, and see myself calm, light, at ease, much as opposed to anxious as I would be, or choking as a perfectionist. Or I see myself asking someone out and being okay about trying out for a play. And it helps a lot, visualization. And remember why? Because the mind, the subconscious, doesn't differentiate between the imaginary and the real. So if I imagine this as a process, it's much more likely to come true. Because the mind looks for consistency between what's inside and what's outside. Remember Stephen Coslin, Professor Coslin's research about this. And also imagining failures at times, not as much, but once in a while imagining failures and staying with these failures, experiencing them, because our fear of failure, or the pain associated with the fear of failure, is much greater than the actual pain associated with the failure. So if we imagine ourselves failing, and again, the mind doesn't distinguish between what's in there and what's out there, been there, done that, not that bad, I'm less afraid of failing, and hence I'm more likely to learn to fail, or fail to learn. So imagining and staying with the failures as well, experiencing it fully. Setting a liberating goal or vision. I first thought about it when I read the biography of the poet, the British poet Coleridge. And he did something very interesting. He was a perfectionist. So what he did, he set a goal for himself where he said, by the end of my life, I'm going to write my magnum opus, my perfect work. Until my magnum opus, everything is a rough draft. Those of you who read or read Coleridge know that he's written a lot of beautiful poems, beautiful prose, essays, philosophical treatises, stunning writing, beautiful. He never got to write his magnum opus. But along the way, liberated by that goal, he wrote a lot. So the way I think about it and what I assumed, I said, I want to have a leadership/excellence institute that I want to run. And I set this goal when I was 25, by the age of 40. I want to run it. Until then, everything is a rough draft. Everything is practice. So when I'm prepared for lectures, I'm thinking, well, it doesn't need to be perfect. You know, it's preparation for. Now, I put everything into preparation, as you know, but it takes away the pressure. It's a liberating goal, because it doesn't have to be perfect. It doesn't have to be right on. Now, when I'm 40, I'll set another liberating goal. We're all familiar with the golden rule, do not undo unto others what you would not do unto yourself. Equally important is what I call the platinum rule, which is, do not do unto yourself what you would not do unto others. What if your friend didn't do well on an exam? What would your reaction be? Would you chastise that friend? Or comfort her? What if your friend went on a date and it didn't go well? What would you do? Chastise your friend or comfort him? And yet, what do we do to ourselves? Why this double standard? And that double standard is critical, it's important, because it's so pervasive in the West. One of the things that surprised the Dalai Lama most when he came and interacted with Western scientists is our use of the word compassion. So when I say, oh, he's a compassionate person, what do I mean? I mean, he has compassion for others. As we'll talk about when we talk about relationships, I think the word in Tibetan, tsewe, which is compassion, means compassion for others and for oneself. There is no distinction between the two. And yet we have readily compassion for others and very little forgiveness, very little permission to be human toward ourselves. Remember the Platon rule. At times we need to treat ourselves as we treat others. Now, a question that I'm often asked, okay, so I'm going to overcome perfectionism where I don't see myself as a perfectionist, but my partner is, my child is, my father is, my mother is. How do I help them? It's a very tough question, and I don't have a good answer to it, but let me just say a couple of things. First of all, it is difficult. It is very difficult to help others because the first step is really, really wanting to change. So that other person, there has to be the true desire to change. The second thing, I think the most important thing, is by example. Sure, we can reward the journey much more. That's important. And it's very important to do it, especially with kids. Reward, remember, effort rather than intelligence or outcome, because then they'll be happier and work harder. Reward the journey, create a new schema. Giving the other person space, permission to be human, permission to fail, true permission in a relationship, true permission to disagree with you. The most we can do is lead by example. And by example means walk the talk or tell stories about your experiences, which is what I try to do in this lecture. Yeah, I talked about a lot of research that's out there, but mostly this is, as you know, my most autobiographical lecture of my journey. Not, you know, long way to go and still improving, hopefully for the rest of my life. But sharing the story and showing. Now, I want to end with a mini halfway summary. I mean, we're beyond halfway of the course, but I want to summarize some of the things that we've spoken of about during this semester. See, one of the things that we talked about a lot, that I spoke about, is that the true name for this class shouldn't be positive psychology. It should be reality psychology. Do you remember me saying it? Reality, because what I'm trying to teach, what I'm trying to get across, is the importance of understanding our nature, our human nature, and adhering to it. So let's take an example. This is the perfectionist compared to the person committed to reality. The perfectionist. There is much concern over failure. There is a lot of pain associated with the fear of failure. Now, in reality, how much pain is associated with actual failure? Well, we know, remember Gilbert's work, Effective Forecasting, ups and downs. We get over it. There is maybe a spike down or a spike up, but generally we return to our base level. So the actual pain that comes from failure is far less. Disconnect here. In terms of focus on the destination, the perfectionist, focus on the destination, a lot of focus. It's all about getting from point A to point B. In reality, going back to Gilbert's work, yeah, there is a spike after we reach a destination, after we get into a good school or after we get a good job or a good grade or a paper, but it's ephemeral. The actual benefit is small. And finally, a perfectionist focuses very little on the journey. In reality, our entire life is the journey. The potential benefit from the journey is enormous. disconnect. Now let's look at a person committed to excellence. A person committed to excellence, there is fear of failure. Everyone has some fear of failure. It's natural, it's human nature. But also understand that there's potential for learning from it and success, and takes it in its stride. In terms of focus on the destination, we all care about the destination, but a person committed to excellence understands that it's another part of the journey. There is commitment to it, but there is focus, but far less than the perfectionist, less obsessed with the next step. Much more focused on the journey. Much more focused on the journey, because most of our life is the present. Most of our life is the here and now. All of our life is the here and now. Most of our life is the journey. There are very few arrivals and destinations. In other words, the perfectionist is unrealistic on these three levels and many others. The person committed to excellence is realistic. Also, remember last time what we talked about. This schema is unrealistic. This schema is realistic. And a person who is not adhering to reality, who tries to attain something which is unrealistic, will inevitably pay a price. We talked about, when we talked about Thomas Sowell, do you remember the constrained vision of reality versus the unconstrained vision of reality? Thomas Sowell, the Stanford professor. And I quoted Francis Bacon, who said, "Nature to be commanded must be obeyed." We need to understand our nature, human nature, which is much more about this. It's much more about this. We also need to understand, one more minute, this is important, one more minute before you pack up. We also need to understand our individual nature in terms of what do I really, really want to do with my life. Because when we adhere to our nature, and this also applies to the optimist and the pessimist lecture, remember what I said, that the optimist is the realistic one, focusing on the 90% full part of the glass. When we adhere to our nature, personal nature and universal nature, because these things are universal, we're much more likely to face happiness at every step of the way, every point, as opposed to ongoing frustration, and we're much more likely to be successful. Happiness and success when nature, our nature and universal nature is obeyed. See you next week.